Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and before I go any further, I want to thank and congratulate all those who worked tirelessly to help pass Amendment 13. Kudos, one and all, and a big yay. I also want to thank and congratulate the Florida Voices for Animals folks for the rousing success of Saturday's Veg Fest, the 9th edition, but first time at Perry Harvey Senior Park. It was a great day and a great event, and I was pleased to see some friends and make some new ones. Didn't hand out quite as many Talking Animals t-shirts as I had hoped, but I did give quite a number away, including to Captain Watson, Captain Paul Watson, who delivered a wonderful, riveting talk, by the way. As for today, my guests are Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard of the Seaside Seabird Sanctuary in Indian Shores. Wilkins is the Director of Operations, while Dollard is the Hospital Supervisor and a licensed rehabber at the sanctuary, which is dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphaned wild birds. The sanctuary is equipped with an avian hospital, which admits some 2,500 to even 3,000 wild birds for care each year. We'll hear how the sanctuary works, how the operation differs from a similar operation with a similar name in the past, and much more when I speak with Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Dr. Heather Judkins, Assistant Professor of Biology at USF St. Petersburg, and one of the organizers of an international conference of cephalopods, i.e. octopus, squid, etc., happening on the campus in the coming days. Finally, a programming note. Next week, I'll be in California on a trip that includes attending and moderating three panels at an international captive wildlife conference, an event held only once every 4 years. In my absence, Glenn Hatchell will be hosting the November 14th show. Formerly a longtime WMNF programmer, currently a dog trainer who runs dog playgroups every morning at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay, Glenn will interview Dr. Kristen Weishar, director of the clinical trials program at the Flint Animal Cancer Center at Colorado State University. This interview is tied to November being Pet Cancer Awareness Month. Sounds like Glenn has a terrific show planned, so don't miss it. Right now, though, let's get to Keith and Melissa for a conversation that we're streaming on Facebook Live from my personal page, that is, on the Duncan Strauss page on Facebook, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Keith and Melissa.
Good morning, Duncan.
How are you guys doing? Thanks for driving over. You guys are not only in studio, but as we noted, you are streaming on Facebook Live, so appreciate any time we can get guests in person in studio. Doesn't happen as often as I would like, so it's a real treat to have you guys here.
Of course.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
So first, I think you might want to clarify some fundamental details about the sanctuary. When I announced the show a few days ago, I heard from some people who fondly recalled going to the sanctuary and taking out-of-town visitors there. So it's true that the sanctuary name is similar to that other one and occupies the same location and I guess does somewhat similar work, but is decidedly a different operation. So Keith, maybe you could just take a moment or two to describe and distinguish Seaside Seabird Sanctuary from one that people might be fondly recalling.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you mentioned, there has been a bird sanctuary and hospital on that location that goes way back. So it's a long tradition at that location. Originally, there was one, the one that preceded us, that was before us, the Suncoast Seabird Sanctuary. They had been there for almost just over 40 years. They started in the early 70s at some point. Ceased operations, closed up, and moved out a couple years ago, back in 2016. And we are a newly formed nonprofit organization, and we moved in there officially in September of 2016, the same year that they closed up.
And I take it that the property is really kind of well suited for being a sanctuary of that kind. Like, in other words, it's hard to imagine like somebody, people would have, the previous folks would have vacated that and somebody would come in and say, well, let's do stores or let's do some other kind of commercial enterprise. I mean, it's really geared for being a seabird and or wild bird sanctuary, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, like I said, since there had always been a sanctuary there for like 40 years, it was already, you know, already had a fully functional avian hospital there, and then with all the pens and pools and all the amenities that you would find at any kind of sanctuary or zoo, something to that aspect. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it'd be somewhere between a waste and completely nuts to do some other operation there, especially with the avian hospital and other gear that's probably just there, otherwise was there waiting to be used. In this way, yeah. So, okay, so Seaside has a pretty short history. The location obviously has a much longer one. Let's hear a little bit about your own histories. Melissa, maybe you could outline your background training and then how you landed at Seaside.
Of course. So I am a federally and state licensed rehabilitator, and I've been doing it for almost 5 years now. I got my license when I was hired on at the sanctuary last year in October. My background, I have a bachelor's degree in animal biology, and I really just spent a lot of time doing internships and volunteering at different locations. My first internship was actually on Vancouver Island at a wildlife sanctuary there called Mountaineer Avian Rescue. I then volunteered with local organizations in this area, and then I spent 6 months down at Crow on Sanibel Island doing a fellowship there.
So are you originally a Florida type that's moved around, including to Vancouver? Or are you from somewhere else and just sort of bounced around?
Excuse me. I was born in California, but I've been in Florida pretty much my whole life. So.
Okay, cool.
And of course, you know, after college, I was like, I want to go, you know, somewhere not in Florida. So I picked the farthest possible place for my first internship.
Yeah, sure. Sounds like
it. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. And for people listening who may not be quite clear on what it means, can you just tell us a little bit about what being a licensed rehabilitator actually involves?
Yeah, so this license, I am allowed to rehabilitate all of Florida's native wildlife, except for gopher tortoises and then the main predators like coyotes or panthers. You actually need a separate license for that. But we abide by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and federal Florida Fish and Wildlife guidelines. They set certain guidelines for the degree of care that we provide and exactly what standards that we have to meet for that. So, but it's pretty much, you know, I can do everything up to what a veterinary technician can do. I'm not a veterinarian, so I don't do surgeries, but we rely on veterinarians that actually donate their services to us. But a lot of what I do is just the nitty-gritty rehabilitative care of these animals.
Gotcha. Okay, Keith, how about you? Trace maybe some of the path that led you ultimately to your current position as director of operations at Seaside?
I spent most of my life managing different companies and different organizations, including nonprofits and sitting on the boards. And actually what started me in this particular field about 8 years ago was I used to do work for the longest time. I was a syndicated music columnist and a concert promoter. And when I promoted concerts, I did a lot of work. I loved doing a lot of work, doing benefit concerts and raising money for different wildlife sanctuaries around the Bay Area and out further out in the state of Florida. And a few years back, when I decided to retire from that profession, I loved doing work for wildlife facilities and care. And so I decided on my off time to start volunteering at one, and it just kind of led to that. And next thing I know, I've got a new career and got hired and then brought on at Seaside and the rest is history.
And what was the one that you first, once you realized, hey, this is kind of where I want to be after moving on from music promoting, concert promoting, and music columnists, et cetera. What was that first wildlife operation?
The first one, I actually was a volunteer at the tail end for Suncoast.
Hmm, okay.
So I'm one of the few people at Seaside that actually used to volunteer at Suncoast.
Right, okay. And, so there is a bit of a through line there, I guess.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, I got you.
among a couple other places that I was doing work for. One was I did a couple of events. I wasn't a steady volunteer, but I raised money for Elmira's Wildlife Sanctuary over in Waimama.
Yeah.
Did some volunteer work for Friends of Strays and stuff like that.
And it sounds like you really, I mean, your hunch was right. It sounds like you really took to it and had like a facility for it, really. Because it sounds like you kind of zoomed along pretty soon, like that was your new profession.
Yeah. I mean, once I hit, and I think it's Melissa's probably the same thing, could probably tell you the same thing, and anyone at the sanctuary, people who do this line of work, you know, we do it because we just love it. We have a passion for it. And, you know, it's one of the few, it doesn't even feel like a job, you know, I mean, obviously like a job, you have responsibilities, which you do, but it doesn't feel that way. I mean, it's one of the few, careers I've had in my life that it's the first one where I've never woken up in the morning and gone, oh, I don't want to go to work today.
I did this yesterday morning. Yeah. No, that's great. That's obviously
very rewarding.
That's pure passion talking, and it sounds like a perfect fit, obviously, with your own interests and abilities and the work at hand. So that's great. Well, as an outsider looking in, I would kind of surmise that the heart, if not the soul, of the sanctuary is the Dr. Marie L. Farr Avian Hospital. So, yes. Melissa, you're the hospital supervisor, so I'd like to ask you to give us a bit of a guided tour to the extent you can of that facility. And Keith, of course, feel free to add some details along the way, but it sounds like that's really kind of the hub of the operation, so I'd really like to hear about that.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's where the magic happens, is what I like to tell people.
Sure. Yeah.
And so a lot of the patients that we do receive, the public brings to us. And we also have some rescue volunteers that do go out and go on rescues. But we admit all different species of birds. There isn't really, aside from, you know, the domestic or exotic species, we mainly focus on native wildlife to Florida. But it really depends on their injury. We see a lot of different kinds of injuries, but we're well equipped to handle most of those. The most common injury we see are fishing line and hook entanglement. That's the most common thing, especially as a seabird sanctuary. A lot of the seabirds, that's the most common thing we get. But the hospital has a lot of space, a lot of different sized cages, depending on the species of the bird. And we also have an intake room, exam room, where we have, you know, several different locations have donated things to us, medical supplies. So we do everything from, you know, suturing wounds to fracture stabilization at our hospital. And then just the general treatment, if they need any kind of medications, you know, we can administer a lot of those. We get those from our local veterinarian. And then from that point, you know, as they're in their hospital, they're either receiving some kind of treatment, we're managing a wound, they're on some kind of medication. You know, it really depends on their injury. And then from there, after they move outside of the hospital, that's really just the rehabilitative care, making sure that these birds can eat, they're eating normally, they're eating well enough to gain weight and go back into the wild, and making sure that they can fly again, because that's, you know, for most of our patients, being able to fly is the most important thing.
So that's probably the goal of the treatment and the rehabilitation.
Yes.
And
let
folks know, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guests are Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard of the Seaside Seabird Sanctuary, which rescues and rehabilitates sick, injured, and orphaned wild birds. If you'd like to ask Keith or Melissa a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. And if you'd like to see our conversation, we are streaming on Facebook Live on my personal page, which is to say, just head to Duncan Strauss on Facebook. So let's go back and talk a little bit more about how that works, and especially get a sense of some of the numbers and the activity over there. So how many birds are treated in a given year?
Generally, it's close to 2,400. Sometimes can go even higher than that, between 2,300 to 2,500 birds every year. The numbers, it depends on the season. Of course, during baby season, during the springtime, that's when we get the most patients admit the most with orphaned birds, and sometimes, unfortunately, bird-napped or kidnapped baby birds.
What does that mean? Who's doing the bird-napping in this thing? I mean, so, I saw the air quotes, and I thought, okay, I'm not sure I even follow this right now. Yeah.
So that's a term that we use. It's kind of like a little bit of a slang word around the hospital, but a lot of times, most baby birds do not actually need our intervention. A lot of times, they actually leave the nest before they can fly, and they spend that time on the ground learning how to to fly, building up their flight muscles and learning how to forage on their own while mom and dad keep a close eye and continue to feed them. But of course, when you see a baby bird on the ground and you don't know, it's very easy to think that that bird is in trouble and they need to come in.
So. I see. So the bird nappers are the well-meaning folks I would see a baby bird and think, oh my God, something's happened.
Yes.
And I'd gather it up and do a nice little box and a warm towel or whatever. I'd call you and you guys would secretly say, okay, he means well, but this is totally
yes, they're totally well-intentioned. Yeah. A lot of times we are able to get those birds put back, but sometimes due to certain circumstances, they do stay in care with us.
And speaking of that, what is, because I think there's some misunderstanding, if not myths, about that. So if you did see that bird, which again, as it turns out, you probably should have left because mom and dad had a close eye and everything was cool. But if you did, again, in that well-intentioned way, take the baby bird, put it in a little shoebox, whatever the thing that people often do is, how often is it true that then the mom in particular would reject them because they've had human contact or for whatever reasons? Yeah. You hear those, I mean, you hear that all the time, but I'm just not sure how often that's
so
actually
that's,
true.
That's definitely a myth. Okay. Most birds actually do not have a sense of smell. The only birds that really do are some vultures. So any kind of human contact with that bird is not going to cause the parents to reject it. Of course, it depends on how long that baby's been taken out of the environment. You know, for certain songbirds, within a few days, the parents could move on and they wouldn't return to that baby. But generally, you know, if you're touching them, you know, that's not going to cause the parent to reject them. You can very safely either re-nest them or just put them in a safe spot in your yard.
Okay. So we've done some serious myth busting right off the bat. So that's good.
Not that we're promoting, you know, going around touching baby birds.
And if anything, I think the other thing we've learned along with the myth busting is that at least, you know, if you're judicious about it, to sort of leave the baby alone, unless they're, you know, more clearly injured or something that's kind of more egregious. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, just let the baby hang and everybody's got it well in hand. You just probably can't see mom and dad who are supervising the operation.
And another thing that we run into with the babies is, you know, the concern of cats in the neighborhood or dogs or predators. And, you know, a lot of times really, you just got to give them a chance. All the birds that you see around, they made it through that period. Just try to keep your cat or dogs out of that area in your yard just for a week or so, and then that bird will be doing his normal life. So.
I gotcha. All right, let's get a caller invite. You're on Talking Animals with Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollar. Oh, sorry. There you go. Sorry, I missed you at first. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Keith and Melissa. I love birds, and I'm sad to see the numbers crashing, both for the marine birds at our shoreline as well as the backyard birds. It's unbelievable how few diversity of species there are compared to even 5 years ago and how few there are now. So I'd like you to comment on their decline and what's causing it. And also, I'd like to know, and it's probably not possible, but is there any program that would allow me to import cardinals or blue jays or other birds and, you know, have a safe haven for them in my yard and allow them to maybe repopulate this area where it seems like they've all died off for various reasons? And thank you very much for what you do. One last thing, I don't know if you heard, just today the UN said that we've got about 2 years to stop anthropogenic mass extinction, which has extinguished already in the last two generations 70% of native flora, fauna, and ecosystems.
Wow. Okay, thank you for your call. So I guess one or both of you might want to first address the decline of the animal, and I guess especially in your case, bird population, and the causes thereof.
So yes, there is definitely a wild birds and all wildlife, you know, they are affected by the things that we do. Mainly habitat destruction is pretty much the main cause of all extinctions and species becoming endangered or threatened within the recent decades. You know, we take up a lot of room and we're destroying their native habitat. And a lot of birds, you know, and different wildlife as well, they have specific niches. And so when that niche is destroyed or altered, there's not always enough time for that species to evolve and adapt to those changes. So that's what we're seeing a lot of their declines in. Just recently with the red tide, we've actually received over 30 red knots, which are a critically threatened species. So that was quite a feat trying to pull those guys through that event. Of course, red tide is a natural event, but it has been exacerbated by human action. So I think the things to be done really just hinge on organizations like ours, as well as other conservation-focused organizations, to educate the public about these different human-wildlife conflict solutions. There's a lot of things that we can do to minimize our footprint and also just educate people about how these animals function, their daily lives, and how we can promote and, you know, protect this species moving forward. You know, responsible fishing practices, cleaning up fishing line hooks, and things like that. I think it's really just overall trying to get people on board and educate them that, you know, we need to reduce our impact. And there's certain things, very little things you can change in your day-to-day that will help.
And I'm sure from what you've said, Melissa, that habitat destruction is a gigantic number one.
Yes.
In the causes that the caller was asking about. Would you say, is there one or two that, even though they're way down the list, perhaps proportionately, that are like causes two and three that come to mind?
Especially in Florida, is just invasive and non-native species introduction. We've definitely seen a lot of damage due to that, especially in Florida with the ball pythons. And, you know, Florida's kind of a perfect habitat for everything, all different kinds of species. So, and with a lack of natural predators to those species, they're able to just wipe out a lot of the native amphibians, reptiles, and birds. So that's another thing, educating people, please don't get your tegu and just let it outside.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it has to be a global effort in educating and just reducing the things that we're doing. So I would definitely say, yeah, habitat destruction, and then non-native and invasive species. Cats also, feral cat populations, they actually kill, I believe, 2 billion birds a year, which is, you know, incredible.
Yeah,
in a bad way.
Big number. Mm-hmm. So, and either one of you, Keith, if you want to jump in, or Melissa, obviously, as well, anything you might want to do by way of addressing his final point, really, about any kind of program, because obviously his concern is the tremendous diminishment of those kinds of species and what can be done on any sort of basis, even just by a private individual with proper oversight or applications or whatever, to help restore one or more of those populations. Is there such a program, and how would that work?
I'm not aware of any individual programs. I would definitely suggest that he could do volunteering with like the Audubon and other organizations such as that. You know, there is a lot of conservation science going on in trying to help these local populations. I'm not sure about any kind of programs of importing birds from other areas where they're doing better. There are certain ones, you know, like the Hawaiian crow, they're doing captive breeding and reintroducing it into their native areas. But it depends on the species. Unfortunately, most species that they're doing that with are, you know, very, very low numbers in the wild or near extinction in the wild. So I would hope that maybe one day we can start doing more of those programs before, so it's less of a reactive measure and more of a preventative.
Yeah.
But
gotcha.
I'm not aware of any individual things currently.
Okay.
And the best thing too to add to that is just in general, if anybody ever had any kind of question about like what they could do as far as importing or anything like that, the best thing we could tell you is to contact the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, FWC, because they would be the ones that would be able to go over the laws on what you can and can't do, and what you could do as an individual as opposed to what needs to be done by a licensed
wildlife organization
like ourselves or others.
I gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so sort of back a little bit to the hospital and the care. So it sounds like you said, Melissa, that the most common injuries are involved fishing line and hooks. What typically are the key birds that you're seeing at the hospital?
In regards to fishing line and hook injuries, the most common ones we see with those are pelicans. We also get the herons and egrets. We actually currently have a pelican that was actually transferred to us from Busch Gardens that received 60 stitches to close a wound in his wing due to one of those large treble hooks that was embedded there. So we actually have a collection jar at the hospital as well that's pretty full. We've been collecting, you know, hook and fishing line that we've cut off of birds over the past few months, and it's already almost full. So
with a bird like that, because that sounds like a very severe injury. What is the recovery prospects, and especially in that case, what's the prospects of that bird being released again?
So it really depends on the injury and then how long that bird was like in that condition in the wild without receiving any treatment or, you know, repairing that wound or the risk of infection. You know, that increases with the amount of time that they are actually in the wild with that injury. Pelicans and most birds, they actually heal very well depending on what the injury is and where it is. The location of this injury, it narrowly missed the main tendon of the wing that actually allows them to extend it. So he got very lucky with that, definitely. So it really, you know, he's on a few different antibiotics right now just to manage any kind of infection that may be present. And then he will probably need physical therapy to make sure that that wing will extend fully. And that comes either manually or just with their time outside in a space where they can actually fly. Which we have a pre-release outdoor enclosure for our larger birds to do that.
So the physical therapy, if I follow you're saying, it could just happen kind of like just by virtue of them being out in that enclosed space. But is there also instances, and again, this that big treble hook, I'm imagining maybe this bird would require more specific intervention that way. So is it you or someone else there that's actually doing physical therapy on the bird? And if so, how does that work? What does that look like?
Yeah, so us and our hospital staff, you know, it depends on where the injury is. But, you know, with proper restraining that pelican, we do focused with regard to his case specifically, we would do focused extension of that wing and holding it for a certain period of time and just repeating that until we see some improvement. Of course, depending on the injury, it can be quite painful. So we give them pain medications. And also, you know, we do it slowly because you don't want to overextend. You only want to do exactly what the wing's allowing you to do.
So. Right, because I would think that the bird, who unfortunately, even though we're at a show that's called Talking Animals, usually they can't necessarily have these things explained to them. Mm-hmm. So I would think the bird could naturally sort of panic or flip out a little bit, like, hey, what is this person doing? And then exactly what I was concerned about is that in the panic, actually injure themselves further.
Yeah, that's a possibility. But, you know, because we're properly trained in restraint and in captured techniques, you know, if you have the bird properly restrained, you can reduce the stress that they're facing. You know, we usually cover their face or eyes with a towel just to reduce that visual stimulus. And then, of course, just reading the bird's energy. If it's getting really painful for them, we'll stop.
They just look super agitated or like they just had enough.
It takes time and experience, but you know, since they can't tell you, ow, that hurts,
right,
you know,
we can tell.
Yeah, you can tell.
The experience that comes with a certain kind of bird watching, no doubt. Yeah.
So. And our larger pelicans, we actually let out in the hospital on recess, is what I like to call it. So I use that as a time, kind of a social hour for them.
Oh, wow.
Because they're a very social species, and so it actually helps their care to be around other pelicans and interact with other pelicans.
So they're still overall in some sort of enclosed space,
yes,
but they can roam a little more freely than otherwise,
and
hang out with some fellow pelicans.
Yes, it gets the hospital pretty messy, but it also allows me to see, you know, if they have a leg injury,
how they're moving
and how they're flapping their wings
and how the recovery is going.
Yes.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, let's take another caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard.
Hello,
it's you. Go ahead, please.
This is Anthony.
Okay. Did you have a question or a comment for Melissa or Keith?
I'm sorry. Okay. This is the very first time I've ever heard anything mentioned about the cat population. I am real happy to hear that. I often wondered how it affected the birds. I live on the edge of the area where it's all nature, and throughout the years I've been seeing a lot less birds around. So I often wondered if that's affecting it. You'll fix a cat and release it. It seems like that's the only solution for these cats, but what about the birds? I mean, that they come first, I would think.
Yeah.
So how much would that play into it? So, you know, the fact that these cats have been fixed, are they still going to be aggressive? And you know.
So it was a question about, like, once these cats are often taken from their colony, and then there's
their fellow cats that are fixed and then released.
Right.
Yeah, so the TNR cats.
Right. Okay. So your question is what happens after then relative to birds?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because on several shows, there was never any mention about wildlife. You know, it's like that was the only solution, but it didn't seem right. So am I mistaken or?
No, yeah. The neutering and spaying, it really doesn't have an impact on whether that cat is going to go and, you know, try to catch a bird for lunch or dinner. You know, it all depends on the cat. It really has no impact on their ability to hunt them either. So it's not a solution in terms of preventing them from actually injuring or, you know, killing wildlife, definitely.
Right, okay. All right, well, I sincerely appreciate your info on that. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
So let me, I want to come back to some things about what happens when they're released or when they're not, but I guess kind of curious to have one or both of you address maybe two or three cases that just stand out to you in your time there, whether the injuries were so severe or the bird's spirit was just so strong, the will to live, or something else that really stood out about, I guess, two, three cases.
So my first couple months when I started at the sanctuary, we actually admitted a juvenile pelican. And she was hilarious, but she gave me put me through the ringer with her care. So when she came in, she was suffering from nutritional deficiencies, and she also was suffering from what I believed was sepsis, which is a whole body infection of the organs, which can be caused by different things. Sometimes it's a leakage in the GI from, you know, maybe a hook or something to that effect. So we pulled her through, we got her eating, she was doing much better, and then I went on my weekend, and then when I came back, she was totally down again, unable to stand, head down, just doing terribly again. So it was another 2 weeks of, you know, every couple hours giving her fluids and tube feedings, trying to get her eating again, and then she pulled through, but we moved her outside into one of our outside hospital enclosures, which are a little bit smaller than our pre-release enclosures, and we use those mainly for, you know, we'd like this bird to be outside so we can say have more space and we can see how they're behaving, but we still need to keep a closer eye on them. So she was out there. We weren't really sure if she was going to be releasable just because her behavior. She wasn't quite acting like a pelican. It didn't seem like she really knew how to be a pelican. It was just the way that she looked around and looked at fish. But then all of a sudden, something just clicked.
Wow.
And we put her out in the general population. It was like she didn't even know us. She was back to being a pelican. So.
Now, in retrospect, do you think what she experienced when you went away for the weekend, and she otherwise seemed at that point in such good shape or doing so well, was that a relapse or was that something else that either had developed or hadn't been dealt with yet when you came back and said, oh my god, look what happened?
It could have possibly been a secondary infection that, you know, because she had just completed her first round of antibiotics, but I believe it could have been a secondary infection caused by her initial injury, or it was just something that hadn't quite completed recovering. But when it comes to, you know, like organ systems such as their liver and everything, if you don't quite, you know, treat the infection of the liver, that's just going to come back and, you know, definitely bring them back down to a severe state.
So you had mentioned that 2,400 birds per year come in. What percentage do you release? I know that's the goal, but obviously at times there must be one thing or another that prevents those birds from being released. Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
Nationally, the success rate in most organizations is around 40%.
40% to be released?
Yes.
Wow, well, that's then lower successful. Than I would have guessed. Wow.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times these birds come into us in quite a broken state. And, you know, just with the stress of captivity, it definitely has an impact on their success with us, especially with certain species. But I believe right now we're at about a 43% success rate.
Yeah, about 43% success rate is what's successfully rehabilitated, and then as far as releases, we're averaging right now about about 928 birds a year is what we're actually releasing back out into the wild.
Okay, wow.
But that's, you know, releasing. Now a lot of these birds we've successfully rehabilitated, but they're non-releasable, so they could be birds that are still, they can't be released back out in the wild, however they still have a good quality life. So either they're living with us and we're caring for them, they're considered permanently disabled, or maybe we'll transfer them to another organization like us, either the Florida Aquarium, who's you know started having birds on display in that, okay. or other areas. But about actually get released right now, we're at average of about 928 birds a year.
And so for the ones that aren't able to be released, what determines whether they stay at Seaside versus go to another facility? Is it something about their particular condition, or is it sometimes just numbers in terms of what kind of space you guys have at a given moment? Or
you're correct on all things. I mean, it depends on several factors. First of all, do we have the room for them? And also, each bird has different requirements, you know, FWC requirements about pen size, you know, height, width, different amenities. So we got to make sure that what available space we have, it also meets the state regulated requirements. And it's also too, if another place is like Clearwater Marine Aquarium or Florida Aquarium or another place like that, if they let us know ahead of time that they're looking for a specific bird, and then, you know, maybe if it's a bird that we already have a few that we're caring for, we'll transfer it to them.
And so here's one other question on treating birds, and then again, some that may stay, some that may be released. But the name of the place includes the word seabird, yet you were nice enough to send me a slew of great photos. And some of those photos show you guys or other sanctuary staffers or volunteers with various raptors.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the criteria for accepting or not accepting certain birds? Because clearly some that you're treating are not seabirds.
Yeah, so we accept all native wild birds. So we have the facility, although, you know, most of our outdoor enclosures are really geared towards seabirds, we do have the proper enclosures for raptors, you know, the egrets and herons. But yeah, we don't really discriminate. We take all of them. And most of my expertise is in raptors of my internships. But of course, seabirds have also been a big part of that. And definitely through my time at the sanctuary recently, I've learned much more about seabirds than I ever knew before. So
so you actually probably came in with more raptor knowledge and then you're adding the seabird thing. So mm-hmm. which is a great mix probably for what's coming up there.
And it's funny because you're not the only one to bring that up. A lot of people think that we only take seabirds. So we found an injured owl. We didn't bring it to you because we thought you only dealt with seabirds and everything. And it's like, you know, I mean, we get in rescue calls. We get in on average about 2,700 calls a year to do birds. And a lot of those, I'm sure it'd be a lot more, but people assume because we do have, you know, seabird in the title. And I think the main reason was that was just because, like you we discussed earlier, that the location that we moved into had such a long
history
of them being seabirds and everything that
makes sense.
When we formed and moved into the location, we wanted to kind of, you know, keep that tradition as far as that. And so that name, we kept seabird in our title as well.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Truss. My guests are Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard of the Seaside Seabird Sanctuary, which rescues and rehabilitates sick, injured, and orphaned wild birds. We are in our final few minutes, but we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. And if you only just had a chance to start listening a moment or two ago, we are streaming this conversation on Facebook Live, which you can find on my personal page, Duncan Strauss. So also sort of related to the history of the place, alongside all the good the sanctuary does to help cure ailing and injured birds, as we've discussed, it's also has functioned and still does as a place to visit, right, and see birds and learn about birds, or even a full-blown tourist attraction. So recognize that we can't discuss prices, even when something is free. Give me a sense of what it's like to visit the sanctuary for just someone who comes in on whatever your visiting hours are.
We're open every day between 8 and 4 p.m. And so the public is invited. We just walk through at your own pace. All of the enclosures that people are able to see with and interact with those animals, those are all our permanently injured residents. So all of the birds that you actually do see, they live at the sanctuary permanently. And we appreciate the opportunity to, you know, have people come and really interact with these birds and get to know a little bit more about their behavior. Because when you connect people with these animals, it does, you know, inspire more of a passion to learn about them and maybe learn about the conservation of that species. So, but, you know, it's a fairly small sanctuary. If you're in a hurry, you can get through it pretty quick. But we like people to, you know, take your time. There's a lot to see. We have a lot of wild birds that just come to visit. In the springtime, we actually have nesting pelicans and herons all in the trees above the enclosures that you can see, and you can actually see the babies in the nest sometimes. Wow. And then as you walk through, you can go all the way down to the beach, and we have a lovely observation tower there as well. And we also have a gift shop with a lot of different little trinkets and things like that for people to purchase and, you know, interact with as well.
That sounds great. I know that you guys are a 501c3, so you're really just surviving on gift shop proceeds, but mostly donations from people that want to support the work that you do. And we should note that the website is seasidesebirdsanctuary.org to find out more about what we've discussed and figure, you know, if you want to help out or get involved or volunteer or any number of things, that's your place to do it. So we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Keith Wilkins and Melissa Dollard, again, of Seaside Seabird Sanctuary. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today on Talking Animals and for all your great work helping all our bird friends.
Thank you so much for having us.
You bet. In a few moments, I'll speak with Dr. Heather Judkins about a big international conference on cephalopods taking place at USF St. Petersburg in the coming days. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is longtime fave Eddie Izzard with part of a piece called Horse Whisperer in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
Horse Whisperers, very touchy-feely horse trainers. Oh, there, boy. Oh, how tall are you? 15 hands. Oh. You got 15 hands? You're Martian? A Martian horse over here. Oh, I see, 15 hands, right. Glad we didn't measure it in feet. Everything's measured in feet except horses, which are measured in hands. What happened there? Someone should be, I'm 9 bottoms tall, you know. Really, are you? Yes. See that building? That's 29 bottoms high. He's 3 thighs tall. 4 kneecaps and a budgie gap. Why are horses measured in hands? What the... Anyway, the horse whisperer's obviously, oh, let's see. Horse is going, I can't quite hear what you're saying, actually. What I said was, why don't you... No, I still can't quite pick it up. Just seem to be going... Horse shouters should get a lot further, shouldn't they? Walk forwards, you, walk forwards. Walk, or I hit you with this child.
That was Eddie Izzard with part of a piece called Horse Whisperer, taken from his album Live from Wembley. Now it's time to speak with Dr. Heather Judkins, one of the organizers of this international conference on cephalopods about to get underway at USF St. Petersburg. This is Dr. Heather Judkins on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Judkins.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So why don't we start by giving us a basic overview of the conference and how USF St. Petersburg came to be hosting it.
Sure. So the Cephalopod International Advisory Council has a large group of cephalopod researchers around the world. It's probably about 800 researchers that are actively studying different aspects of cephalopods. And every 3 years, there is a triennial event where we all come together and discuss the recent advances in our science. So KIAC itself, which is the acronym, started in 1983 with a small group of cephalopod researchers, and it was then decided that it would be hosted in different countries throughout the world every 3 years. So in 1988, it was in Washington, D.C., and then since then, it's been in various countries around the world, from Japan to Australia to Brazil, for example. And the last one in 2015 was in Japan. And I was interested, because it had been so long since it's been in the U.S., to propose to host it here. And I proposed my idea and what the plan was to have it here at USF St. Pete in downtown St. Petersburg, Florida. And I won the bid.
Wow. So well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
So is it just that there aren't enough significant advances in that field that it would make sense to do the conference more frequently than every 3 years? Or are there other factors, too, that dictate that?
Well, no, there could be. I think the one unique thing I love about this conference is that it is obviously the truest to what I particularly study, right? So every talk I see during the week is cephalopod related, where all of us also interact with other aspects. Some of us are physiologists. Some work with fisheries management. And so there's lots of other conference opportunities to highlight our work there as well. Some of the work I'm personally doing now is with the Gulf of Mexico, and there's multiple platforms to share our science in that way. So I think when KIAC was established, it was kind of established as a three-year gap is enough for us to produce some good new data, introduce some new graduate students and young researchers into the field as well, and then, of course, meet up with all the old veterans in the field to see where everybody has been doing.
Great. And I guess I mentioned it earlier in the show, but I guess for people listening who didn't hear that or might not know off the top of their head, cephalopods are like octopus, squid, et cetera, right? That's what we're talking about?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
Squid, octopus, and then there's some relatives, some similar.
Lesser known relatives.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And so I get the sense that there's an opportunity, I think I read somewhere or saw somewhere, that there's an opportunity for regular folks to attend a presentation or a part of this, even if they're not academics or otherwise researchers in the field.
Yes. We, for each of the KIACs that we've hosted in the conferences in the past, we have tried to incorporate the community at some way, the local community, to get them involved with what our science is. For example, when we were in Japan, they literally are called the City of Squid. It was in Hakodate, Japan. So that led itself to having a panel of squid scientists interact with the local fishermen. And there were 400 people that came to that panel discussion, which
wow.
was great.
Yeah.
For us, we do have a fishery in the Gulf of Mexico, but it's nothing like that. So I could not follow their lead on that. But we always like to encourage outreach as well. So what we're doing on Saturday, November 10th, this Saturday, from 10 to 2 p.m. down at the USF St. Pete Ballrooms in the Student Center, we are having kind of exploring creatures of the deep, squid and octopus. And this is a public event. There are stations kind of set up around the ballrooms where they're all interactive. So there's everything from interactive games like moon squid beanbag toss to arts and crafts and other type involved projects and activities they can do with squid and octopus.
That sounds great. So, Dr. Judkins, is there a website or Facebook event page or something where people could find out more about the event on Saturday? Because I assume that the layperson wouldn't make sense for them to go to other parts of the conference, but this is totally aimed at them.
Exactly. This is the one part where public are more than welcome to attend. We have it posted on the KIAC website, which is CIAC. If you pop that into a Facebook search by chance, that would come up, and it's on that page. It's also posted through USF St. Pete. So if you go to the USF St. Pete pages, it's one of the main pages in the news articles this week up on the website.
Cool. Well, this sounds really interesting, and we just have just a brief moment or so left now. But what are you presenting? What are your topic or topics at the conference?
Sure. So as I mentioned, my work has been in the Gulf of Mexico, and a group of researchers and I are studying the deep sea of the Gulf of Mexico since the BP oil spill. So since 2011, there's been a group of us looking at animals that are about 4,000 feet down deep, never towards the bottom of the ocean. This is all something we call the midwater column. And we are pulling up all kinds of organisms and looking at abundance numbers, who eats who, are there any possible contaminant situations that could be going on in this deep water. These are all the weird animals, like, you know, the anglerfish with the lures above their head and things like that live in total darkness. So I'm going to be presenting on the squid findings or the cephalopod findings that we have had since 2011 at the conference.
That sounds really cool. It sounds really interesting, and I like that those are the weird ones. That sounds all the more notable. So Dr. Jenkins, we have about out of our time here, but thanks for joining us on Talking Animals and filling us in. Sounds like the conference is a very cool, prestigious thing to land, to be hosting it, and that's great. Big kudos to you, and look forward to folks joining you on Saturday for kind of a more public-oriented version of it.
Great. Thank you so much, Duncan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lillet. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Right now, it's time for Name That Animal Tune, and this is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a DVD copy of Blackfish. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song that we're, in fact, hearing right now, which is very related to our conversation with Keith and Melissa. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. If we have folks that want to guess, we'll take their calls off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity. Again, next week, Glenn Hatchell will be here in my absence with a great show, including that interview with Dr. Kristen Weishaar, director of the Clinical Trials Program at the Flint Animal Cancer Center at Colorado State University. Don't miss it. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Also, I invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook. And, of course, there should be some Facebook Live action there now from our conversation with Keith and Melissa. And you can also like the show and or me personally and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other scintillating news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond, the last local radio station in Tampa Bay. NPR News headlines are next, and then Rob Lori after that. See you in a couple weeks. Thanks.